This is Take Two.
How's training going?
Training's good.
I trained today. I have another blister now.
Where?
On my heel.
Oh, stop. That's annoying.
Training's good. Yeah, listen. I started training officially for this about 7 months ago. That was when my official training plan began. And I think it's like anything, you know, I was really excited for it. For the training aspect, obviously I'm super excited for Everest and can't wait to get going there, but like the training, I was looking forward to doing everything, recording it now, but I've kind of hit a wall in regards to training, and mentally I'm just like, I'm really struggling to be there in the training session. Now that said, I'm getting them done, you know, I'm improving week on week, because a lot of the training sessions are the same from the week prior, and the idea is they just slowly increase it. And
yeah, they're repetitive.
So you can kind of, you have something, you have a benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I'm hitting all the marks I should be, you know, my coach says I'm good, but like mentally, I feel I'm hitting the wall a lot, and I'm having to go to that place where I don't want to go, where I'm trying to get myself out of it, you know, to stay with it and that. So recently I went to London over to where the guys who coach me are from London.
Is it like a coaching agency? Like,
yeah, their name is the Altitude Centre.
Okay.
And they coach a lot of the Everest climbers from Great Britain and the UK. So I was kind of their first UK or Irish, I think, doing Everest, who contacted them. And in their training centre in London, they have simulated altitude rooms. They have simulated boxes that you can take home and sleep with. So,
oh, I saw that on your story.
Yes, that's right. So,
oh my God, that looked like a fake.
That's another story now. But anyway, so I went over to them just to break up my training block, because it was getting too repetitive. I was getting sick of it. So that was a nice little break there 2 weeks ago. And I now have another 2 weeks of training before I start tapering off. So, it is what it is. It has to be done. But I'm really looking forward to just getting going now, giving it my best shot, and having one task, one goal at the top of my mind, as opposed to all these separate goals regarding training.
What, in regards to training, how do you actually train for a summit?
Well, listen, if there was a right way, we'd all be doing it. There is no right or wrong way. You know, the likes of Nims Day, who I presume everybody knows now from his Netflix show, 14 Peaks, you know, mountaineering has really become popular these days, especially with all the shows on Netflix. So, I mean, Nims is the elite of the elite. You know, he's Sherpa blood. Those guys are genetically gifted.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm not blessed with those genetics. So I have to train extra hard. You know, Nims can, you know, he can get fat. He can go for a couple of runs. He doesn't need to get to that, you know, that Everest shape, as I like to call it, like the rest of us. So he's the extreme. The rest of us are in the middle. So I've taken as much advice from different people who I know have climbed or attempted Everest, and I've taken bits of nuggets from each of them, and I've kind of put it all together, and I've kind of adapted my training to suit me, as well as taking the bits that I liked from everybody. So in saying that, what is it? I made it my goal when I set out to do Everest, that I was going to climb it accordingly, increasing in difficulty, right, in terms of mountains. So the seven summits, I wanted to start at the, you know, technically the most easiest and the most successful, and work my way up. And in doing that, gaining experience, getting
which
knowledge.
Which is the easiest?
Well, Kosciuszko is the easiest in Australia. You know, it's a day, but you would leave that to last, just to kind of tick it off. I've happened to do it because I spent a year in Australia.
Okay, fair enough.
So Kilimanjaro is often done first. Everybody's first taste at altitude, more or less. And then from there, you kind of go on. You could do Elbrus in Russia.
Mm.
Unfortunately, now, not really going to be a good thing. And then Aconcagua. It's always those two mountains you do, get a taste of them. Elbrus is really, really tough summit day. You're in the cold a lot. Aconcagua is really, really high. So you're kind of getting a taste of what the next step of the mountains are, because they're going to be altitude and cold.
Mm.
So they're nice base level. And then from there, you can go on to Denali in Alaska or Vinson in Antarctica. So you have these super extremes there regarding cold and height. And then obviously finishing with Everest. So
yeah.
I've kind of, that was my goal when I did that. So I wanted to get all my, I've taken all my my training knowledge, if you like, for those mountains, and I've adapted them and put them to Everest. So in saying that, what am I doing? So for Vincent in Antarctica last year, my idea of training was all cold. I wanted to be as comfortable in the cold as I could possibly be. So that involved ice baths. I was doing, you know, two ice baths a day, 20 minutes a piece. I was swimming in the sea, you know, I was wearing t-shirts, shorts in winter. I wasn't wearing coats, no gloves, no hats. And I was just getting really, really comfortable being uncomfortable in the cold.
How long did that take you to get comfortable in the cold?
I was always somewhat doing it, okay. But I bumped it up. So, but like, I mean, 2-3 months, I'm convinced that cold training is a mind battle over physical, you know.
100%.
And if you start telling yourself that you can't do it, you're not going to be able to do it. But I think if somebody wants to get into the cold, once they're okay with their health and stuff, a short space of time. I think 8 weeks, you could go from absolutely nothing to 20-minute swims in the sea in the likes of February and March when it's the coldest.
Crazy.
Ice baths, 100%. Yeah, I just think it's a mind thing. That's my opinion. So I did all that. Antarctica was good. Denali was coming. So that's the highest mountain in North America, in Alaska. So Denali is kind of the beast of all the seven summits. Technically, physically more demanding than Everest. If you take away the altitude aspect, Denali is much, much more tough. So on Everest, you have the benefit of the Sherpas who will carry a lot of the gear for you. So they say that, you know, sometimes you just have to show up and walk and deal with the altitude. Obviously, yeah. You have to do your training, but, you know, the Sherpas are the heroes on that mountain. Denali is different. When you fly into the Alaska mountain range and you land on the glacier, you are there for 3 weeks. You've got 80 kilos worth of gear for you that has to get up that mountain for 3 weeks. So you're part of a team, but, you know, you're pulling the camp gear and stuff, but ultimately it's your gear. You know, it's sufficient for one person for 3 weeks.
Mm.
So what does that entail? That entails getting to going from where the plane drops you to base camp. So that's about a 12K hike. You've got to carry 80 kilos worth of gear to camp one. And that's fairly flat. There's only about 300-meter, 400-meter elevation in 12K. So not that hard. From there, it's up to 1, 2, 3 camps. So what we used to do is rotations in that. And your bag and sled combined weight would be about 50 kilos. So in doing that, you'd have to go from base camp to camp one, take you about maybe 6 to 8 hours, depending on the weather. You would dig a 10-foot hole. You'd bury your gear. You come back down to the camp prior, you'd sleep, and you do the exact same the next day with the same weight. So that was what happened all the way up to camp three. From camp three onwards, it's a very, very steep ice wall. Unfortunately, you can't get your sleds up that. So it would take maybe 2 to 3 rotations in your bag of about maybe 20 kilos up fixed lines, ice, to get it up to camp four. And then from there, you would make it your summit bid. So Denali is a complete beast. So that was my training for that. Was just heavy bags out in the hills for long days. Like, I mean, it was sport specific.
Yeah.
Getting strong, core, gym work.
Like a lot resistance of that. Cardio, sort of.
I wasn't that focused on cardio. Really? I thought the cardio would come in the way I wanted it. Being able to run 20 kilometers was no good to me.
Yeah,
I had to be able to walk 20K with 25 kilos on my back.
Yeah, like a big bag on a Stairmaster.
That's
instead.
It, yeah. Day after day. So that was what Denali required. So obviously I did that in my training. Everest doesn't necessarily require to carry all these heavy bags. So
Okay. Hence
why I'm not focusing as much on heavy bags. You know, today, for example, I did my incline treadmill work in the gym and I had 12 kilos in my bag. But even when I go out on the weekends into the mountains, I would never have anything over 12 kilos because it's pointless. Mm. It's not going to benefit you.
And why is that?
Well, because you don't need to do it on Everest. You know, okay. Everest, my bag.
Because of the Sherpas or?
Well, the Sherpas will take a lot of your gear. So up to Everest base camp, you have the yaks. Mm. They will take a lot of your gear. The Sherpas will carry a lot of your heavier gear higher on the mountain. Now, that said, you obviously need to carry your oxygen tanks, your water, you know, extra gear that you might need in your transit from whatever camp you're going to. So I never go over 12 kilos and I've really I'm training kind of like as if you were training for an Ironman combined with gym work. So it's a big focus on endurance and a big focus on strength and gym work and power as opposed to bodybuilding and hypertrophy. No hypertrophy. So it's all low reps and conditioning like CrossFit conditioning combined with endurance work like you'd see Ironman guys going for.
Tom, why?
Good question. Like, yeah, well, I mean, why? It's a question I always struggle to answer.
Especially, obviously, I'm sure everyone has told you about the stories about Mount Everest, so we're not even going to dive into that.
Mm-hmm.
But there is quite a safety risk, like you can't go into it all willy-nilly, which you're clearly not, but a lot of people do that.
Mm-hmm.
Is the view that gorgeous?
up on Everest?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you in 6 months.
Or all of them. Like,
I love being outside. I love the mountains. And I think on the run up to COVID, so obviously like 2018, 2019, people were starting to fall in love with the outdoors a lot more. And I think COVID has really pushed everybody to the outdoors. You know, I work in the hospitality industry and they're unrelated, but I can see the drinking culture is changing. You know, pubs aren't what they used to be. Like what our parents grew up with, pubs, that's not a thing anymore. You know, the Netflix and chill has changed that first. And then now I think COVID has really told everybody that, like, you know, life is short. You know, so everybody, I think, is making the most of their weekends these days. And in saying that, they don't want to be hungover on the Sunday. So, you know, so a lot of people aren't drinking out anymore.
There has been a shift to sobriety.
I think everybody's, you know, the off trade in the drinks industry is increasing. I think, be it wine and drinking at home. And people wake up on Sunday feeling good and they go for their hikes and they go to the gym or they go for a walk, whatever it is. So I loved that before it was what it is now. And when you're out there in the mountains, like, I mean, the stress of the modern world and work and all this isn't there. Like, you know, you're able to switch off. You have just one goal at hand and the goal is to get up and down that mountain safely. And you know, that in as a thought is very nice. And you know, when you have your downtime, you can just you're really able to take in your surroundings because you have none of this outside stress that seems to be, you know, battling you in every day. Like, for example, for me, like the last 6 months have just flown by. Like every day is a stress for me because I'm waking up and, you know, I always have a niggle in my body. You know, I'm always sore somewhere. So I'm like, shit, do I need to recover there? Do I need to ice that? I've got training. I've got 2 hours of training this evening. I've got to get to work. I have this, I have that. So like all of a sudden it's 10 o'clock in the evening. And in doing that, I'm trying to get my food into me, my dinner. I'm trying to do my rehab for whatever sore, watching TV at night. And then all of a sudden it's midnight. And then I'm up at, you know, 6:37 and the day starts again.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a blink of an eye, you know, and it's suddenly March now, tomorrow. And, but anyway, so I love being there. I love just taking it all in. I love stepping away from the real world as well. And I love having a goal, a single goal like that.
I was reading your blog and you mentioned that someone explained to you Skull Cinema.
Yes.
And that really stood out to me.
Oh, you like that? That was Sam Benson. He was my guide on Elbrus in Russia.
Okay.
And he said it to me. Elbrus was my first taste. Elbrus is in Russia for everybody. And it was my first taste of snow and altitude combined.
Okay.
Kilimanjaro, there's no snow. Aconcagua, there's no snow, but there's altitude. So this required big boots, you know, big high altitude mountaineering boots, crampons, so your spikes for your boots. And it's a really, really long summit day. So, you know, most of the time summit days are 800 meters, 900 meters in incline. Elbrus is double that. Elbrus is 2,000 meters. So we got going. Weather was shit at the beginning and we had a break. And I don't listen to music. If I train with somebody in the gym, so I do have a training buddy and we listen to music, we just throw it on the back. But if I was training solo, I don't listen to music.
Why is that?
I don't know. I never really liked it.
Okay,
I just I just go into my head and I kind of told Sam this and my guide. And he was like, I'm the same as you, Tom. I don't listen to music. And he called it his Skull Cinema. So just go somewhere in your head, let it play. And I think it's a really nice thing that you're able to do that. A lot of people can't do that. A lot of people can't train without music. I can. And when I'm on the mountains, it's just me and the noise of my feet going one after another.
Yeah.
My breath.
It's like a meditation sort of.
Yeah, it is like a meditation. Kind of go into a trance and before you know it, you're 50 meters up, 100 meters up, you know.
What are the biggest lessons that you got from these 6 summits that you've done so far?
What are the biggest lessons?
Probably mentally rather than physically.
Yeah, I mean, David Goggins, obviously everyone knows who David Goggins is. Like, David Goggins talks about building resilience. And, you know, I've listened to a lot of other people talk about inspiration, getting inspiration from David and this idea of building resilience. And I think mountaineering is one of the most difficult sports out there and probably the best for building resilience. And like, if you want to know what you're made of, I reckon, like, sign up with Earth's Edge and go climb Kilimanjaro, go climb Aconcagua.
Because there's a risk associated with it.
There's a risk in everything. You know, of course there's risks. Like, people die on these mountains. Exactly. Like, you know, they do. Obviously, get your heart, you know, get heart checked. You know, it's often people's first time at altitude, which causes a lot of these problems.
Mm.
So oftentimes it's altitude related illnesses, and you know, you might have an underlying health condition that arises at the time. So obviously you get that checked. But I mean, if you want to know what you're made of, go climb a mountain. Go climb a real mountain. Nothing like we have in Ireland. Go climb, you know, one of these big boys in the big mountain ranges, and you're going to see what you're made of. So I've, you know, doing these, like I always say that, like, your body, your mind will come up with 1,000 ideas.
Yeah.
Very, very, very nice ideas to turn around. But it only gives you one to keep going. And it's that idea of just focusing on that one to keep going and training your mind and your body to do that. Very hard to do it in training. You can't really push your body and your mind to the extremes that you can on a summit day of a mountain. So I like to say, listen, the best way to do it is to go out and do it. And then, you know, you build it up. So, that's probably the best thing. And it's my advice to anyone. Like, I don't think you can go wrong in signing up for one of these mountains and doing it. You know, it's a fantastic experience.
And what's the industry like, in fairness? So, like, let's say I have decided that I just want to start. I want to give it a shot. Is it somewhat gate-kept? Is the information quite easy? Do you have to watch out for scammers?
It depends. So let's say you want to go.
Let's start with the easiest Everest one. We're talking Kilimanjaro. One. Like, general population, beginner, like first recommendation.
Kilimanjaro is what you would recommend to everybody. It's so accessible. The tourism industry in Tanzania and Kenya is so structured around Kilimanjaro. It's very easy to do. Now, that said, obviously, if you have budgets, you can find cheaper ones there. But it's all very safe. You know, there wouldn't be much scamming going on there. You know, it's relatively cheap in regards to mountaineering. You know,
how much are you looking?
Like, Kilimanjaro can be anywhere from maybe 3,500 to 5.
Well,
you know, including flights. So, you know, you look at Everest, it's only a blink. It's only a little percentage of what Everest costs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So Kilimanjaro is fine. When you start talking about the bigger prices is when the scammers start to come in. You know, it's like anything. And yeah, we could talk about more of that later. But yes, not a huge amount of scamming in the lower level of mountains, because, you know, there's not a huge amount to be made from it. I've no experience. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I haven't heard anything like that. And I can't see why.
Because a lot of people, I think maybe the biggest hesitation is, I'm going out in nature and I'm going to go through a grueling thing.
Yeah.
And this is going to cost me tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Why the fuck am I going to do this?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And why does it cost so much?
It costs so much because an expedition is long.
Because the guides, right?
That's part of it. But I mean, you know,
How long is the expedition?
Kilimanjaro is a week. Mount Everest is 8 weeks.
What?
Denali in Alaska is 3 weeks.
That's a long time.
It's a long time. So
it's very long.
You're paying for all the hassle to be taken out of the gathering of food, you know, access to the mountain. You know, Alaska, you're flying into the mountain. So it's propeller planes, you know, bus rides to there. The guides have to make money from it as well. Mm. So like they're getting a wage, you know.
And is food served?
Depends who you go with. A lot of these mountains, you know, I know people who have, I wouldn't say cheat the system, like, you know, a summit to summit, but you know, a lot of people say that, you know, true summit to mountains is when, you know, you have to do it the way it was done. So like the likes of Alaska, you know, you show up, you pull your gear up the mountain, you know, you suffer, you endure.
Yeah.
You carry that 80 kilo bag up and you've summited that mountain. You've earned that. But, you know, there are companies, even on Denali, which is probably the most regulated mountain out there, who offer a service where they have previous camps. Camps are set. And I know people who have done those and they didn't have to carry the bags, you know. So they walked up and they strolled up and they did it, you know. So that if they had done it properly, not properly, but like, you know, if they'd done it carrying their own gear, you know, that might not, they may not have summoned it.
Mm.
So, I don't even know what your question was. Am I going on the right one?
Sorry. No, I'm just I'm enjoying this. Keep going.
Yeah. So that I like to think that you should do it the real way. You know, even on Everest, my company sent me an email I sent them saying, have I all my forms in? Is everything ready? They said, yeah, we just need the final payment for your, it was called like the executive plan or something. And this was, I was like, geez, I don't know what this is. I can't remember signing up for this. So I went onto the website anyway and I looked it up, and it was this luxurious, massive tent at base camp of Everest with a, you know, a little over bigger than a single bed. No, there's a solar charger there. There's a little, you know, side table with a lamp. You know, I, listen, people, each to their own. If you want to do that, do that. But I don't agree with that. I think if you're going to Everest, get in the tent, sleep in the sleeping bag and go on from there.
Yeah,
you know,
like it's part of the story.
It's
imagine
part of the story. Yeah, you know, you can't. Yeah,
especially if you're well prepared for it. I think that's probably the main thing there.
Yeah.
Is that if you do it the real way, I'm assuming or I'm hoping that you're well prepped in all regards. And I think even if you are over prepared, there will still be something that goes wrong.
Always, plans always don't go to plan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You make a plan and God laughs. That's what they say. But in saying that, it's like, what usually goes wrong? Besides like the injuries, the sicknesses and everything that everyone discusses.
Weather. Weather is your biggest enemy out
and
there.
And that's out of your control.
It is totally out of your control. And like, I keep going back to Denali. I'll go to Vinson, for example.
Go
so Vinson is the tallest mountain in Antarctica. It's very inland.
What's Antarctica like?
Like Antarctica, flying into Antarctica is like...
Like, do they have shit there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Pretty cool. Like, I mean, the setup in Antarctica is actually really nice. So what happens is, which I find funny, is you have to get to the bottom of South America. When you that's where you wait. So you fly into Chile, and I went through COVID, so I was in hotel quarantine waiting for my results. Then you fly down to Punta Arenas, which is one of the most southerly towns in Chile. And you're in a hotel there and you're waiting for extraction from there onto the ice. Now, it's a 4-hour flight. The first flight of the season is a massive cargo plane, which is what a lot of the photos are, which is pretty cool. So when that goes, you're not getting that anymore. So we actually were waiting for a Boeing 757, which is a really big plane.
Okay.
Iceland Air. And anyway, so we ended up waiting 6 days in Punta Arenas doing nothing. And each day that came, it was like, we might be going today, guys. So you're on standby all the time. And
what happens to your return flight?
Return flight is it's the same idea. Like, I mean, so when you don't fly into the mountain. So when you fly into the ice, you fly into this. It's the American side. So you fly into it's called Union Glacier, and it's quite a large. It's probably maybe two acres, and it's enclosed, you know, because there's crevasses around, so you can't go wandering. And might even be bigger than 2 acres, but you're in camp, and from there, everybody leaves to do whatever excursion there is. So a lot of people go to the South Pole to go see the penguins. There's volcano exploration going on. And then there's obviously Vinson. So it's about a 40-minute flight from Union Glacier to Vinson. So there's a lot of waiting around because Antarctica has its own weather systems all the time. To fly into it on the big plane, they need super clear days because the pilots get confused with cloud cover and the ice because there's no runway. They land on the ice. So it's a blue ice runway.
Like literally just slip and slide. Jesus fucking Christ, man. No.
And if you want to hear something bad, it was when we were waiting to get into the ice, onto the ice, there was a group of Americans. Oh, I think they're American, but they were doing, there's a challenge I'm thinking of doing afterwards. And it was 7 marathons, 7 continents, 7 days. So the first marathon is on South America.
Okay.
That's the start date. But obviously they didn't know what day they were flying into the ice. And we had 6 days extra waiting around. So every day when we woke up and we thought we'd be leaving, we see them out starting their run. So they ended up doing 6 extra marathons.
Feck off.
So that was one. And then that's the start date. And then they get to Antarctica. They do 2. It's a 10-mile loop. They do it 4 times.
Oh my God.
And then they fly out again. So that's that. I mean, so the weather is, to go back to your question, was what can go wrong? The weather is the biggest unknown factor there. You know, if you had crystal clear skies, no wind, no avalanche, no nothing like this, you know, you know, a lot of people could get up those mountains, you know. And
the wind is the bastard, huh?
The wind is the bastard. I mean, that can, you know, that can change the temperature from, you can go from minus 20 to minus 50, you know, in a single.
And it's even the resistance.
That's
that
what I mean,
too,
in 10 minutes, So Vincent, for example, you know, the summit ridge is, you know, there's a 100-foot drop on this side. The summit is no bigger than this table here. So when you're standing on that, you know that the wind's pushing you off and you're going to drop.
Funny story, though.
Okay.
I have always been, like, heights were never like a thing for me, right? And this time last year, I was like, all right, let me go down to fucking Hoth. And I didn't know or I didn't think, but that was Paddy's Day weekend.
Oh, last year?
Last year.
Okay.
So all the tourists ever that fucking existed in this world just were in Hoth.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that through. walking, and then all of a sudden, I just see this like, quite a small path, in my opinion, anyways. Remember, yeah. I'm foreign as well. This, like, we don't have mountains back home. We're fucking hills, and that's it. And I take a step, and I feel someone's presence behind me, someone's presence in front of me, and then a gush of wind. And my hat just goes...
Gone?
No, just a little bit.
Oh, okay.
And I felt that risk, and I didn't squeal, but I was like a little bitch.
Into a little ball.
Little ball. Back, and I was just like, what the fuck is wrong with me?
Yeah.
Like, I was beating myself up so hard, like, you pussy.
Like, as you turn back.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do Hoth.
Yeah.
I was too comfortable doing Bray to Greystones my little, like.
But you got comfortable doing that.
I got so comfortable.
Well, you can see what it's like when people start panicking you. And
You
know, and like, I mean.
Just someone's presence behind me and in front of me freaked me out.
Uh-huh.
Like, let alone.
It's kill or be killed on these mountains.
How do you just like close your eyes and walk on, like when you have like a small path like that, like, or do you have a rope to hold on to?
It depends where you are. I'm not that scared of heights, evidently.
Okay,
but there are very like there's squeaky bum moments, as Alex Ferguson would say, on the mountains.
Squeaky bum.
There's a famous traverse in Alaska on Denali, and I don't think it gets enough recognition. And going into it, I said, feckin', I'm gonna record this. But I couldn't record it because it was too scary. And there was no ropes. And this is the problem. So when you climb Alaska, when you climb Denali, let's say you, me, and another person were climbing.
Mm.
You're in teams of three. So we were. In the teams of three, we each have a sled. Okay? So we have a 20 kg bag, and we've got about a 35 kg sled.
What's the sled for?
Sledders carry the extra gear, the 35 kilos that you can't carry.
Jesus.
So a combined weight of about 50 kilos. Okay. So imagine this now, and you're climbing, you've got your boots on, your crampons on, your ice axe in your left hand. It's about minus 20. The wind picks up and there's a traverse coming up. Okay. So I'm at the back of the group.
What's a traverse?
A traverse is just a section of climb, often with a fall on either side. Yeah. So it's kind of just from A to B, but it's just
it's
up on the mountains.
Yeah, it's just like a mountain version of like a gymnastics beam.
Yeah.
Okay,
like, yeah. So there was a traverse coming up of about maybe a windy corner. It's not that long. It's only maybe 80 to 100 meters, right? But it's blue ice. Okay. It's about a black diamond vertical in terms of skiing, right? That's just the level of slope. And on that, there's a very skinny path, skinnier than this table, where the feet have flattened it out.
Mm.
So there's no ropes to hold you to this side. And to this side, you can see it's just sheer drop off of blue ice where you're not going to be able to hold on, and then into a big crevasse. Okay.
What's that?
A crevasse is the opening of a glacier. So a lot of the climb is on glaciers. So when glaciers open and stretch and crack, the gaps in the middle are called crevasses. Okay. So
you if you're going to be a slushy down
well,
there.
Some crevasses go to 100 feet deep. You know, there's no end to them.
Oh.
And so this is, you know, I said I'm going to video this thing. The second I got to the top of it, I said, right, phone away. I'm not doing this. And
phone away, shat my pants.
Yeah. And I my left glute, because I put so much weight on this side, because you have to, you rope up your sled so that it stays behind you and in front of me from being the back climber. So when you come to the windy corner, you will unclip that and you'll do another knot where the sled will actually swing out to the right. So if you're climbing here, it... with the slope comes out to the right. So the sled is pulling you down to this crevasse. You know that the ice is slippy and stuff, so you have to watch every single step, and the person behind you is kind of tugging on the rope as well.
Mm.
So it's a very uncomfortable situation. And, you know, if you didn't like Hoth, I can't imagine you'd like Windy Corner.
Are you an overthinker?
I'm a big overthinker, yeah.
And what the fuck were you thinking in that moment in time?
Well, I mean, those situations just... Just go straight into it. I love a challenge, you know. So
yeah, that's not a fucking challenge.
That is a challenge. I love a challenge. So I wouldn't necessarily overthink challenges. I would overthink everyday problems.
Yeah.
But not challenges. You know, I look at these things. I wouldn't overthink in regards to mountaineering and stuff, you know, for a lot of the time, because I like to think that my preparation has got me to where I am, and I'm confident in my preparation and confident in my experience and skill to tackle whatever it is in front of me.
How do you prepare for a slip and slide like that, though?
Windy corner. Well, now, in fairness, we did have techniques if you did fall.
Which are? Hold on and scream.
Yeah, well, obviously there's a self-arrest with your ice axe. So the ice axe is always held up. So okay. If you fall, the idea is that you put your weight into the ice axe in your chest, and you're trying to get your feet down below, head up high, and you basically stop your fall. Now, that's not always as easy as said. So you're constantly talking to your teammates.
Okay.
So if I was at the back, I said, moving. If I needed to stop, stopping. He would stop. He would tell the guy ahead. Okay. If somebody did fall, you were trying to highlight that.
Falling,
yes. Yeah. So it was a case of that anyway. And, you know, if someone did fall, if you were not the faller, you were self-arresting into the slope in front, which would hold it and let the person who fell get their feet, climb back up.
Wow.
So that's the idea, you know. So
there are plans.
Teams of three eliminate the risk. Mm. No, don't eliminate. They diminish the risk a bit, but they don't eliminate it.
Is there a reason for the teams of three? I feel like I heard this.
Not necessarily, like the solo teams as well, you know.
Yeah, okay.
It's just safer in teams of three. There was nine. There ended up being nine clients on my full team. Mm. One went back, so eight, and there were three guides. So it made sense to do that ratio. But like, I mean, there was one-on-one. Like if you do a solo ascent with a guide, you know, it's just one-on-one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's obviously less safe. The safety numbers in that instance.
100%.
Yeah.
I once heard that like it's safer to be in trees because if something happens to someone, it's like one person can fetch for help and the other can stay with the person.
You have two people to help. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe that. Yeah.
No. Oh my God, that's so fucking scary.
Yeah.
Okay, grand. I actually have goosebumps. Like, that's unreal.
Well, it's a pity because if anyone's listening to this and is about to do Denali, get a chest strap and video Windy Corner because it hasn't been videoed and it's not on YouTube.
GoPro it.
Yeah, GoPro that thing. Just because it needs to get out there.
Oh my God.
It's a great section of the climb.
Yeah. I can't, like, did you find out or like do you I'm assuming you read everything about this sort of stuff, but like I'm sure that everyone mentioned it to you beforehand.
But it's like again, it doesn't get the status that it should, I feel like, because there's no photos of it. Like most of these parts of the climb have status because they have photos and people can visualize them and this. So there was no photos of this thing, you know. There's one video or two on YouTube, but they're shite. I thought I'd be the one to bring back the video, but I got too scared.
Fair enough. How long did that take you?
That section? Corner. Oh, not long. Like, I mean, 30, 40 minutes. 40 minutes maybe, yeah. But it's called Windy Corner because it's so exposed. So as you come around, like, that's why it's all blue ice, because it gets hit by the wind all the time. That's why the snow is all, no snow settles.
Ugh.
And just gets cut down to the core, just blue ice.
Yeah. Oh my God. So. We're so comfortable here, aren't we?
We're so comfortable, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the one thing that you probably got like after challenging yourself time and time again, is that you come back and you're like, yeah, it's grand, like.
Yeah, it's grand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's like anything. Like, I mean, the human body is so adaptable.
Mm.
And, you know, I often think, like, shite, do I need to be sleeping in tents out in the stones to prepare myself? But when you get there, you kind of just get on with it, and you know,
you have no choice.
Within a day or two, you're kind of just adapted, and you're there, and that's kind of the logic and the idea that I'm bringing to Everest.
Yeah,
yeah.
Now, when it comes to the adventure itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you fly in, and then, like, from
this
what
is Everest now?
No, just all of them. Okay. So just mountaineering summits in general. Is it walking? I know you explained walking from camp to camp to camp, but then there's summit day.
Mm-hmm.
What is summit day?
Summit day is the day you summit the mountain. So,
you actually climb up.
Yes. So it depends what mountain you're on, right? So let's break it down.
Yeah.
Each mountain has camps, okay? Depending how big the mountain is, it has more camps. So Kilimanjaro has camp 1, 2, 3, and that's high camp. 3 is your last camp.
And that's like a flattish.
No, most of them aren't flat. The lower ones are flat.
Okay. So that's before like the peak of it, correct?
The peak, yeah. So
got to.
Summit day is always the toughest day on the mountain because, you know, it's the highest you've been on that expedition.
Mm.
You know, each step you're getting higher and higher. There's less air every time you step.
I see.
And it's really steep. Conditions are always the shittest when you're going for summit day. Obviously you want them good, but I mean, it's always going to be the coldest and that. So Kilimanjaro, you never go back down. You climb to one, you climb to two, you climb to three, you climb to four, and you go for it. Okay, so you summon on day five on Kilimanjaro. Denali, as I said, you have your base camp, one, two, three, four. There's four camps. And you climb to one, you bury, you come back down to the little camp below, you do the same the next day, sleep, do the same the next day, you go from one to two, bury, come back down to one, sleep, go, and you move to camp two.
Why?
Does that make sense? Because first of all, to get your gear up, because you wouldn't be able to bring 80 kilos in one push. And secondly, because it's really, really good for acclimatizing. So that's why expeditions on big mountains are so long, is because of the acclimatizing factor. So, like, I mean, you could rock up to Everest and say, feck it, I'm going to go for this in 6 days. But, I mean, your body's going to be fucked. And, you know, you know, stats will tell you that you're going to just crumble at the top because you're not acclimatized. The body doesn't know what's happening. It's going to just break down. And the longer your body's in altitude, it will adapt. Once you're not sick, it will adapt. Some people are faster than others. So that's why we acclimatize. That's why we spend so long. Everest is an 8-week expedition. You know, I won't see Everest base camp until maybe day 16. You know, we're hiking in for 8 days. We're summoning another mountain, Lobuchet. That takes about 3 or 4 days. We come back to that turnoff point and we take another maybe 3 days up to base camp. So that's, you know, day 14, 15, 16 that we arrive. Then we have a couple of rest days and then we start our rotations, which are just acclimatizing. That's going to camp two, sleeping, coming all the way back down to base camp, having two rest days, climbing all the way to camp three, which takes 3 days. So you climb up to camp one, sleep two, sleep three, sleep maybe, all the way back down to base camp, take 3 days off, do it again. And then that brings you up to like May 10th.
Wow.
From there, you're a couple more rest days and then you're waiting for the weather to present itself for summit day, for summit push. From base camp, it's called summit push because you got to go through all the camps again. Because you're not, you know.
And that's in one go, sort of?
One push. So a push on Everest for the summit from base camp might take you 6 days.
Wow.
So you go to camp one, you sleep. You know that on Friday, let's say, the weather's going to be good, Friday, Saturday. So you want to go, you want to be at camp four, you know, by Thursday night so that when Friday comes, you can go for the summit in the good weather.
Mm.
So, you know, in the meantime, you'll come up as you need to.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So a lot of people say, Jesus Christ, that sucks. But like,
yeah,
I was actually thinking today, I was like doing my, when I was giving out, when I was fucking fighting my own mental battle as I was getting my blister on the treadmill, I was like, where else would you be? You know, if you weren't here, you'd be doing something else that you'd be giving out about. So same thing happens when you're going for your summit day. It's a pretty nice place to be in the grand scheme of things.
I feel like you'd probably want to like take a photo with every view that you see.
Yeah, you do.
Like, it's one of those things where it's, you just incredible, want to stop.
Mm. And the big thing with summit days is because, have you seen the movie Everest?
No.
Okay.
Those things scare me, man. They creep me out.
Well, that would scare you because that's about the 1996 disaster. So everything goes wrong.
Okay.
It's when 14 people died because they summited too late. So on Everest in particular, more so than other mountains, you'll have a turnaround time. So when you leave your high camp, you know that you want to summit by, is it 8 hours later or is it 12 hours later?
Mm.
But your guide and, you know, the experience in your group, you'll know what that is. You know, so let's say you leave camp. We're thinking we're going to reach the summit in 8 hours. But if we don't, we have a turnaround time of 12 hours. Mm. So if you've gone over your 8-hour schedule by 4 hours and you're still not at the summit, you have to turn around. And a lot of the time people get summit fever, they push on, and that's when the dangers happen. So that movie...
What's summit fever?
It's like white line fever. It's like going for the summit when you shouldn't.
Oh.
You know, knowing to turn around is not summit fever. Summit fever is you're in really bad condition, you've passed your turnaround time and you go for it.
Oh, okay. When you shouldn't. That's the bad decision need to get there.
It's a bad decision. So the idea, I'd like to say I don't have summit fever. I'm very happy with not summoning if that, you know, that presents itself. You know, I don't think I need to get there. You know, I enjoyed the challenge.
Could you try it the next day though, or no?
You wouldn't.
Oh.
You know, you're spent. You know, you've kind of done everything you can to get there, and
wow.
Yeah, you've kind of expended yourself, and all your oxygen is gone. For example, on Everest, wow. You know, so obviously each mountain is different, But you, and also you don't have the time and money to go for it again. Mm-hmm. So you kind of only really have one summit attempt.
Like you get it, but it's a bad decision.
It is a bad decision.
It's your life.
It's your life, yeah. So that movie is a domino effect of bad decisions that ultimately leads to however many deaths on that mountain.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Have you seen any bodies?
No, I haven't seen any bodies now, touch wood. Now, there's not traditionally many bodies around on the mountains I've done, you know, because there's not as many deaths, but Everest, because it's so dangerous to take the bodies down from the death zone.
You're expecting it.
Yeah, well, they're there. Yeah. You know, there are dead bodies up there that are known as landmarks, and you know that it's left or right or this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I heard of the Sleeping Beauty, for instance, as well. Like they freeze up and they just stay like that.
Mm.
I think that's going to be a very interesting journey of yours, where I wonder if you'll come back a changed man, seeing
a lot of people
mortality
say they do.
There.
Yeah. And like, you know, they're the ones that stay there. Like a lot of people, on average, there was four deaths last year, which is pretty low for Everest, you know, considering there's 1,000 climbers, you know, it's a pretty good ratio and percentage, but you know, the ultimate reality is people do die and do fall. Not all of them stay up there and are solidified into the mountain like there are up in the death zone. So, you know, a lot of people say that, you know, be ready for that. You know, things do, like, shit does hit the fan on Everest. So,
besides the weather, has anything else gone wrong that you had to adapt to in that moment in time? I know you said something about your mitts and how it was really cold. I forgot which mountain it was.
Yeah, that's okay. On the last two mountains, I've had cold fingers and cold toes. So, is that it's kind of counterintuitive when you're building your base layer for your shoe, for your foot, and for your hands, because you think the tighter the better, but it's actually not like that. It's what's the best insulator is trapped air. So you want space. Wow. In your hands. Now, I've got big hands, which makes buying gloves difficult because my outside glove has to be really, really big because I have four gloves underneath it, as well as my hand. So they don't make them in like triple XL, you know. Yeah. The double XL is the max they go to on some of these high altitude mountaineering gloves. So it's really, really tight in there, you know. So it is difficult to keep your fingers warm. You have a bag strap as well. Bag strap's going to cut off the blood supply in your shoulders, which obviously supplies your hands and which obviously makes them colder. So I think it's part of it is experience. Like, I mean, shit, it's going to be uncomfortable. So like on Denali, for example, summit day ended up being, I think, 14 hours for us. Every 30 seconds for 14 hours did I take my hands out of my glove and clench a fist and swap ice axe from hand to hand, because obviously the metal of the ice axe will make it colder. Now you wrap that as well, but it doesn't really do much.
Crazy.
So for 14 hours, I was constantly clenching my left hand, then I would switch to my right hand because they were getting so cold. So I had to just do that. Feet is a harder job to do that, but you like to think if you keep moving, you'll keep the blood supply in the feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the toes.
And this mental fatigue, I think,
there is mental, like, you get so tired doing that.
Yeah.
Honestly, yeah. So, I mean, again, it's like, how do you train for that? You can't just go up and do it and get good at doing it.
And then you have to figure it out.
And figure it out, yeah. So I think the best way of training for that is just go do a mountain and be really, really cold.
No, that's amazing, honestly. I feel like the stuff is so original and interesting because, as you said, very few people get to do it.
Yeah.
And like marathons are becoming trendy, and how they talk about, like, if you finish a marathon, you're part of the 1% in the world. Mm. But like, let alone this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's so cool. What's, I hate to be that person, but I know that you're attempting to become Ireland's youngest person to climb all seven summits.
Yep.
What's next? Once you finish that.
Yeah, well, my girlfriend won't like me talking about it, but I'm trying not to give much thought to that. You know, because I've been asked that question a lot, and I just say, listen, I'll tell you after Everest. There are things I want to do.
Besides a book?
No, I don't. I'm not into books.
No?
Nah.
Ah, stop. Really?
No. To write, I like reading them. I won't. I have no interest at the minute in writing one, but I don't think I'm worthy enough to write one.
No, at all.
The Explorer's Grand Slam is a thing as well.
What is that?
I haven't looked into this as much as I've, like, I'm a complete nerd when it comes to mountaineering. I know all the facts and, you know, the Explorers. I think there's two Irish people ever to have done it. I think it was a guy. I know Pat Falvey did it. And I can't remember anyone else who did it, but it's the seven summits and it's the North and South Pole.
Okay.
So that's that.
So there's shit over there in the North and South
Pole. No mountains. Just okay. Getting to that point and doing them correctly. So it's not cheating because you can fly to the South Pole and you can get off the plane, you can stand, get a photo and you can get back on the plane and you can go home.
Yeah.
But it's to ski the last degree. So obviously there's latitude lines around the earth.
Uh-huh.
Your last latitude line.
Uh-huh.
South and your top one on the north. It's about a 7-day ski on the south, a flat ski in the Antarctic. So that's the last degree, if you like. So to ski that to the South Pole.
Okay.
I'd like to do that. And then the North Pole is trickier because half the year there's no ice on it. Mm. So there's also there's no point. South Pole has a big beam with a big sphere on it. Yeah, you know you're there. Uh-huh. North Pole is just we're here.
Okay.
Because you don't know what it melts and then the ice comes back. So there's that. There's loads of other things, you know, like Marathon de Sables and this crack. So yeah, I'll tell you after. Ask me in 6 months.
Listen. You have such cool ideas, though. It's like no one. I never thought of that. Like, there's so many people that roam this earth, not thinking about the earth. And here you are talking about skiing, fucking the South Pole. Like what? That's so cool.
And what I talked about earlier as well—the people doing the marathon on each continent.
That sounds fun.
I think I'd like to do that.
How would you know anything in regards to like how they plan it?
If you look it up, I can't off the top of my head, I can't remember route they do. But
is it like a flight?
It's a done route, but they go with the time, so it saves them.
Whoa.
To go whichever way that is.
People are so smart, man.
Yeah, I know.
Like.
There was a big group. There was about 20 people doing that.
Yeah.
You know?
Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. So. I fucking love that stuff. Okay. So after that, I also want to talk to you a little bit about the Wim Hof breathing thing that you did in Poland. So interestingly enough, I had brought on Neil O'Murku.
Okay.
Who's kind of like one of Wim Hof's right-hand man. He's like probably the Irish Wim Hof.
That's right.
Like, let's put it
that
way.
He's a qualified instructor, isn't he? And
yeah. He leads...
He's in the burn, is he? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He also does a good few retreats around Ireland, but he also goes to Poland to instruct like the people on behalf of Wim Hof, sort of. Which is quite cool, in fairness.
Yeah.
Did you actually see Wim?
No, I would have been in Neil's group.
Yeah.
But not him. I was with a different instructor.
Yeah. Is it to become an instructor?
No.
Or was it just for the crack?
It was totally for crack and for athletic
like
purposes, as I said. Yeah. Because I was doing it and I heard, like, mountaineering, like, 2 years ago wasn't what it is today. There was no, like, you know, NIMS has really put it through the roof.
Oh, my God.
You know, and everybody knows everything about mountaineering. I met a guy last night who has never climbed a mountain but knew everything about it. And, you know, just through pure interest. And he said, Tom, I'm never going to climb one, but I love it.
It's so easy to go down the rabbit hole, though, through Wim Hof, in fairness. Because it's like, oh, ice baths, cold showers, and then you end up on Andrew Huberman.
Like, what's the next step? It keeps going on.
And then you keep going, and you're like, holy shit, man. Yeah. It's literally just like the trifecta of Joe Rogan, Wim Hof, and Andrew Huberman. and then you just like expand it outwards.
That's a good way to put
it. That's basically it. Anyways, how was that for you?
That was good. Like, I was swimming in the sea. So, again, it all goes back to these challenges that I did. And I did a challenge in November and December of 2017 or 18, and I swam for every day. So I was like, let's go crack. And then I was like, let's go one step further. Let's go to Wim Hof's, you know, stomping ground, and looked up the courses. If you want to do it with him, it's really, really expensive.
Yeah,
it's
heard.
Like 25,000 or something.
Jesus fucking Christ.
So,
I need to stop swearing like that, actually.
So I did it with Ronald Smith. He still does it now. He's from the Netherlands, but he did it out in Poland. But we didn't see Wim Hof. And I knew I was doing it for athletic purposes. That was, and for the crack. But I'm also very aware that a lot of people who take on Wim Hof's, you know, beliefs and trainings are doing it for health benefits. Like, it is very sad what happens there. You know, I brought my cousin. I convinced my cousin to come because I knew I could have fun with him. But everyone else in our group was recovering from something. And we were the only ones there, athletic purposes. And we had a nice time, but it was very sad to see.
It's like emotional.
It was very emotional to see who was there and what happened in their lives that brought them to this point. So, yeah, that was that aspect of it, and the fun aspect, if you like, was like we had a good time, and you know, it was very fun. I still do it today. I don't do it as much. the breathing. Now, they say it's somewhat correlated with high altitude. They say that the breathing can help, but I don't know.
Considering all the adventures you've been on, who is Tom now in comparison to Tom before all of this? Because I feel like you might have learned a lot of what you're capable of, or what humans are capable of.
Well, definitely what humans are. Like, I mean, as I said to you earlier, like, I mean, the human body is so adaptable. And I've kind of realized that, like, it honestly would take a lot to fully, like, the body can do so much, and the mind is the biggest winner. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can tap into what your mind can do, like, I mean, you can actually make the body do everything. So it goes back, like, even I always say, like, when you hit the wall on these mountains on your summit days, you know, and your mind has come up with thousands of ideas to turn back around and only one to keep forward, like, it's your mind that gets you out, and that's where the resilience is being built. And I just think that's what I learned. Like, I mean, I wouldn't have had that mental strength, you know, back in 2017. You know, I was just a kid.
How old were you?
2017, how many years ago is that? What are we, 23, 6? Yeah. So 21.
Okay.
21 and a half. Yeah, I'm 28 now, so it was at the start. But I was 21 when I did Killy. That's why. So like I remember I went to a wedding before I went to Killy, like the week of. You know,
you were like, this is going to be a breeze.
Yeah, and there I was, you know, and it's really interesting that, you know, as young guys, you think that you're going to just smash this thing, and, you know, you've kind of lived your whole life in school, and you're playing sports, and you're playing against younger siblings and cousins. You think you're unbeatable.
Yeah.
You know, all mountaineering is one foot in front of the other, but it's so difficult. And, you know, young guys, which is interesting on Kilimanjaro, is every day we're first to camp. We're miles ahead of the old group. You know, we had 20 people in our group, and we had age ranges from 13 to 70. So huge range of age. And every day, who was rocking up to camp first? Young guys, me, my cousin, my brother. We were there first every day. What happens on summit day? Who's at the back? The three of us and all the other young people, you know. Mm. So it kind of kicks you in the face, and you kind of, you know, it's humble learnings. That's what it is. And
it's the lack of wisdom that only comes through experience,
yeah,
though.
It is, yeah. Experience is the best teacher.
100%. Like, you sound like you know this shit like the back of your hand now. Well, which makes so much sense.
I would talk to guys who've done Everest now and you know, much bigger mountaineering feats than me, and they put me in my box in terms of knowledge. 100%. But I'd like to think that I've done all the research that I should and can do.
I think it's about giving certain challenges the respect that they deserve, mm-hmm. and identifying the fact that you can't do all the training overnight. You're not going to show up even a month before, like, with training and whatnot. Or you're screwed.
I have to be careful what I say now, because it's funny that you say that. But it's, you're spot on, the money is there. And
don't be too careful. Don't censor yourself. You're grand. Like,
yeah, no, yeah. It's just, I know people who, you know, who fall into that category. And it's one of the things, like, I mean, like, there's a famous guy, famous mountaineer. He's kind of, I think he stopped climbing now. His name is Alan Arnett.
Okay.
And he's like Michael Bublé in terms of he only shows up around Christmas, but Alan Arnett only shows up around every season. Okay. And his podcast revives about 2 months prior to every season.
Why is that?
Because that's all he's interested in. He goes quiet for the year, but he knows everything.
Every season.
He obviously has so much research. He has so many ties to people in Nepal, in the Himalayas. So he comes out, and he's actually really interesting if you want stats and stuff on Everest. And he was just, his first podcast this year was released 2 days ago. And he's talking about what you're saying there now about people, it's the other end of the spectrum, is people who aren't ready and are showing up to these mountains and kind of, you know, making them harder for everybody, the likes of me who've done their research and, you know, paid their dues. You know, he talks about the people who are showing up and, you know, making it difficult for others who haven't paid their dues, you know, making it unsafe for both clients and guides and Sherpas on the mountain because they've got money, you know. And it's unfortunate that it's happening, but Mount Everest is unregulated in the regards that it will let as many climbers on as who pay. So
that's the annoying thing.
It is annoying. And, you know,
and money talks.
Well, money talks in that instance, because, I mean, the Sherpas make a very nice wage from climbing, and it's a very short season. So they make a year's wage in a 2 month season. So they will do that, and you know, there's no gatekeepers on ever saying, well, sorry, no, you can't go on that mountain, you can't go up now because you went yesterday. They don't give a rat's. Yeah. You know, they'll go, and you know, often their cost of expedition is lower. So you have a lot of people who are trying to hit records as opposed to enjoy it and climb, and they're the ones who are kind of adding traffic to the mountain, and they're, you know, if you look at it, like, imagine everybody was well rehearsed and well trained. I mean, it's a lot safer on the mountain, you know. Then throw in all these people who know nothing about the mountain. They can't tell you what their brand of boot is, you know. They don't know how to use an ice axe. They can't tell you what their glove is, you know. They're not getting
they probably have no interest in it except for the photo at the top.
That's it. Yeah. And, yeah. That's the problem with Everest. You know, a lot of the other mountains aren't as bad because they're not as dangerous. You know, you're not in that altitude, that death zone for as long. So you can get away with it on other mountains. But unfortunately, it comes to the front on Everest. And I get a bit pissed off with it, to be honest, just mm-hmm. seeing people doing this, you know, not being able, you know, you should know your gear inside out going to Everest. You know, you should know where it works, where your Velcro is, how to use it, how to tie it, you know, spare laces, this crack. You know, I know people who, you know, don't have suits, don't have gloves, and, you know, wow. And, you know, you should be familiar with the stuff you're going with, because it's unfair on the people who are there and have paid their dues climbing.
It's probably unfair on your family as well if something were to happen, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, not yours, but like, if you don't respect it enough.
Yeah.
It's like, you're not immortal.
Yeah, well, if you look at the beginning of the climb of Everest, which is the most difficult.
Okay.
So from base camp to camp one, it's through what I talked about earlier, the crevasses.
Mm-hmm.
It's through a field of crevasses, okay? And that's called the Khumbu Icefall. Historically and statistically, the most dangerous part of Everest, most deaths have happened here, and it's only at the beginning. That requires all the ladder crossings on the over those big crevasses. It should take an experienced climber, you know, no more than 30 seconds to cross that thing. You throw in 200 climbers who've never climbed over a ladder before, or have never even trained with a ladder before, or done their knots, that can go from 30 seconds to 5 minutes per one for one person. So multiply that by 200. That's where the traffic jams happen. That's when you're exposed, you're in this crevasse field, which is super unsafe for a very long period of time, which is totally unfair.
Yeah, it's an individual thing, but not exactly, because there's a community around you.
Yeah, and the problem is, ideally, you'd like there to be a governing body on Mount Everest saying, well, sorry, you don't hit the criteria here.
Yeah, it's like a Boston Marathon qualification.
Yeah, exactly. You're not allowed on this. But, you know, who am I to say you can't climb Everest? I've never done it.
Yeah.
But I, like, that's my two cents on the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that should be fair. That it should be regulated like that.
I agree with you.
Mm.
As in, maybe not all six summits, but two, three. Like, they could put, like, a different quantity on it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where else was I going with this? In regards to, like, we're in Dublin, right? Mm-hmm. How or where do you go to train?
So, funny enough, in 2019, January 2019 was 2 months before COVID started, I think, right? Am I right in saying? No, 2020.
2020, yeah, March,
sorry,
2020, yeah.
To go to 2020. But I built a gym at the back of the house in our shed. So I have that, and that was the spot from a lot of
what
my training.
What equipment is there?
Say again?
What equipment do you have? Like, well,
that was the thing. It started off with just a squat rack.
Okay.
And then COVID happened. Any bit of money I had went into the gym. So now I've got my assault bike, my rower, my incline treadmill, all the weights, kettlebells. Okay. I like strongman.
Perfect.
So I have all my sandbags. I've got, I know guys in carpentry, they built me the boxes because everything was sold out during COVID with all these gym companies. So that was home gym. Then I needed to step it up a notch for all the bigger mountains. So I started going to a professional strongman training center, which is one-on-ones. That's my buddy Dave out in Meath. So I'm with Dave all the time, and you'll see cuts on my hands here. That's from lifting the big rocks on my Instagram. You'll see, so they're Atlas stones. So I love that. That's kind of a fun aspect of his way. Strongman combined with conditioning. I do that. Then I'm also swimming out in UCD Olympic pool. I'm a member of another gym in town here that has a treadmill that goes to literally like that in terms of verticalness, if that's the thing.
May I ask you how much you're paying a month?
65 for my gym in town and 80 quid a month for UCD pool.
80 quid. Okay, because then... So, I mean,
like, if you break it down to, like, what a standard CrossFit membership is in one of the Dublin city gyms, it's minimum 200 a month. So, you know, I'm not going even near that.
I thought that was going to be way pricier, I'll be honest with you. I'm assuming Meath, like, your friend, so you're getting that.
Oh, yeah, they're good rates. They're like, helping. I mean, he's not, yeah.
Okay,
so,
great.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's less than a CrossFit membership. Amazing. And it's a pity because I hurt my foot at the end of November.
Mm.
And that took running out of the equation for me for training.
Yeah.
Because running's a really nice way of just monitoring the heart rate and running at a heart rate level and a zone. But I haven't ran since the start of December. So hence why I joined the second gym, because I had to replace running with cycling and treadmill.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a pity, but listen, nothing goes to plan, as you say.
Exactly. Okay.
Yep.
So there's that. And then obviously Mount Everest is going to cost you a little bit. I know that you sold out your whiskey.
I sold out my whiskey. I just got another batch in this week, but I had to get it out to the guy who ships it for me before I release it.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
So first of all, well done on that.
Thank you.
In saying that though, how much, I know this is not for charity, so this is coming out of pocket.
Yeah.
How much is it going to cost you?
So Everest is interesting. So it goes back to what I was saying earlier about people skimping it and going on the cheap. So I think the minimum you can do Everest for is for 45,000. That's the minimum. Maybe 40 if you look around. But a lot of the time that's with Nepalese companies who have the lay of the land. You're skimping with... You know, if you do pay 45, it's because you're cutting something. There's something not there.
Wow.
You know, whether it be food, you know, whether it be Sherpa support, whether it be oxygen towards the summit, you know. So all things that play a big factor in you getting to the top. So that's the lower end of the spectrum. But I know it goes all the way up to about 120,000 for the average person. I know NIMS charges, I think, over 200 as a solo guide.
Yeah.
So... I'm in the middle. I'm standard range. I'm minus 65,000.
Crazy.
Plus 10,000 insurance. So unfortunately that's
You have to.
You have to, unfortunately. But listen, it's a big commitment, it's a big goal, and thankfully I've got a great team behind me. This has been in the pipeline for a long time. So, you know, when I went to companies to say I wanted sponsorship, you know, it wasn't a shock to them. You know, they weren't surprised. They were like, "Oh, this time has come." Well, yeah, listen, you've hit the other six, you know, I think you're going to get good traction on this. And I've got some great sponsors, Sullivan's, Key Capital, Bunsen Burgers, and Earth's Edge are great. Great Outdoors. I was up in Great Outdoors the other day. They were making sure that I was fully kitted out for all my gear. They've got great knowledge in there in terms of layering and stuff. So they're great. And then obviously the Temple Bar Pub, that's home to me. You know, that's family, and thankfully they were a great sponsor as well. They've always been my top sponsor, but it still left a big void to the final price tag. So this is where my whiskey idea came, and I think I was originally going to do it. I was flirting with the idea of doing it for charity, but I kind of felt it was unfair to do that, especially after.
It would be another job for you.
Yeah, it would be, but I think after COVID, a lot of people were kind of tired of giving money, and I never thought of it that way.
You're
and
right.
A lot of people. You know, it was an unsteady time economically in Ireland, especially. So I didn't want to be pressuring people to, you know, to give me money for this big holiday, if you like. You know, people are like, "Well, I'm just paying for you to do a trip." So I didn't want that. So I said, "Listen, I want to give back. You know, you buy something that I produce, and that's 100% going to go towards my climb and my Everest fund." And that's where I came up with the whiskey. We're in the whiskey business as well, so it was nice that I could do it from there. So
was it like in house and all that?
No, it's not. We don't distill it.
Okay,
but I work in the whiskey industry, so I know a lot of the, you know, where to go and stuff. And
that's so exciting.
I know a lot of the people there. So yeah, that was good, and I made a great whiskey. It's a 10-year-old single malt, and I did. My label is really cool. I got a really good guy to do the label. I met him online, and never met him in person, never did a Zoom call, all over email for over a year. And we got a really, really nice intricate label highlighting all the six summits, Everest up top. And my first batch, I had 126 bottles. The price is the height of Everest. So Everest is 8,848 meters. The price of my bottle is €88.48.
Fair enough.
So we're sold out. Batch two coming soon.
I can't wait to get my hands on that. That's going to be fucking amazing. I can't wait, honestly. Listen, considering that I can't even walk hoth, I think I'm all tuckered out in mountaineering and all that.
Fair.
When are you going? When are you going to climb?
I leave exactly 4 weeks from today. Tuesday, 4 weeks.
Best of luck.
29th of March, yeah.
All right. I genuinely can't wait.
I appreciate it. Yeah, perfect. Thanks a million, Debbie.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Yeah, all right.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for listening/watching. Bye-bye. I've been to myself, just me lately. I don't need a lot. I don't